This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good evening and welcome to a special edition of Night on Earth. I'm Shifa Situ and this is your weekly digest of global culture and living. So we're going to start at home, where we speak to four local musicians from various stylistic backgrounds, and we ask them to reinterpret the idea of a national anthem, using their own musical vocabulary to, you know, interpret what a national anthem should mean to them.
You got your usual signifiers of nationhood, you have God, Kedaulatan, and the people. I think that's the three basic necessities for any nation in this world.
So this is, of course, a program about global culture and life. And today, in Remembering Madeka, we draw parallels from our own struggle for independence to events happening in the global arena. Tonight, we'll focus in on Egypt.
And it is the first time that this happens anywhere in the world, comes out in the street to demonstrate and say, no, it's enough.
I spoke to Raouf Boutros Ghali, who is the UN General Secretary's brother, and gives us a unique insight into events in Egypt. But first up, what's in a national anthem? This is not a remix of Ngaraku, but four original tracks composed by local musicians that speak to a Malaysia of today.
Hi, I'm Azmil Yuno. I wrote this song, Tanah Airku. I think this song, in a way, kind of represents a more ground level, you know, of patriotism, love for the motherland. And I like that word Tanah there because I think we're all grounded creatures as human beings and we're on land. But other than that, I think the way I've written this is a bit more neutral. You got your usual signifiers of nationhood, you have God, Kedaulatan, and the people. You see? And I think that's the three basic necessities for any nation in this world. And I kept it very simple because I think a lot of national anthems are very simple, easy to remember, and you can hum to it, you can play it without extra accompaniment. So I feel that with just a guitar, I think if you can sing your national anthem on a guitar or even something smaller like ukulele, I think that's a very effective national anthem.
Malaysia, damai dan merdeka, sepanjang zaman semangat rakyatmu cekal. Malaysia, maju dan makmur, kerana rakyat pembela kedaulatanmu. Oh tanah airku, oh tanah airku, oh tanah airku, oh tanah airku. Malaysia, ibu pertiwiku, dirahmati oleh Yang Maha Esa. Oh tanah airku, oh tanah airku, oh tanah airku. Tanah airku.
That was Azmal Yunor's take on a new anthem for Malaysia. You're listening to Night on Earth with me, Shifa Situ, and tonight we're presenting a special Merdeka issue. Next up, the composer Jessica Cho takes a minimal approach to her anthem for Malaysia.
Hi everyone, I'm Jessica Cho. I'm a freelance composer and a music lecturer. So today I'm going to play my piece called Peace. Yeah, this means we need a peaceful life in Malaysia. The music is very simple. I was given this 1 minute task, so I was thinking to do less things in 1 minute instead of more things in 1 minute. So I hope the audience will take out their time to listen to all the small details in the music. And it's just like our life, we need to take out 1 minute time to listen to your everything in your life, the wind, the sound of wind, the sound of even the dog barking. So enjoy your life for that 1 minute. Yeah, as we are a developing country, so we are busy every day. So we don't want to overhaul our engines. Yeah, we need to take out time to be a peaceful mind. Less is actually more in music, in your life, and in everything you do. Try not to do too much things. Although we are Malaysia, Malaysian is a rojak country, sometimes refers as. But sometimes if you do less, it means more for you.
That was Jessica Cho, and you're listening to a special edition of Night on Earth, the Merdeka issue. So our final reimagining of what an anthem could or should be comes from sound artist Goh Lee Kwong. It's a track that includes a crying baby mixed with elements of post-rock, indie and ambient sounds to paint a rich and evocative tapestry. Check it out. This is Night on Earth on BFM 89.9.
你好, my name is Goh Lee Kwong. I'm a sound artist. Merdeka is a day for the Malaysian to know that they are independent. And Malaysia Day is a day to remember the united of the East and West Malaysia. I think a song about Merdeka and Malaysia Day has to be with a taste of independent. So I composed a song with the element of indie music such as post-rock, electronic and lo-fi.
Thank you.
All right, so that was the final cry from Go Li Kuang's composition dedicated to Merdeka and the upcoming Malaysia Day. So you're listening to a special edition of Night on Earth where we celebrate independence. So I think the cry of a baby is an apt metaphor, as growing up is never easy. Now coming up next, we head to Egypt, which is in the throes of a difficult and violent transition in their search for self-determination. This is Night on Earth with me, Shifa Situ, on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, this is Night on Earth, and I'm Shifa Situ. So, for our global story tonight, we head to Egypt, where we're reminded that independence is not just declared. It's not just a moment in time, but a continual struggle for self-determination. Since the Arab Spring and the protest in Tahrir Square in early 2011, which led to the overthrow of Mubarak's government, Egypt has been in the throes of spasms of violent transition. The democratically elected Islamist Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood came to power. But clashes between demonstrators and supporters continued to mount. There were attacks on Coptic churches and Shiite Muslims, which culminated on June 30th when millions of Egyptians took to the streets calling for Morsi to step down. On July 3rd, he was removed by a military coup. Earlier this month, the military-backed interim government has cracked down on the Muslim Brotherhood, killing more than 1,000 supporters, which Human Rights Watch has described as, quote, the worst mass unlawful killings in the country's modern history. So this is a complex story and one that questions the limits of democracy. Is it better to have a democratically elected thug or a potentially liberalizing military dictatorship? It's a question that's polarizing the Egyptian nation. So the interview I'm going to present now does not aim to be a completist approach or to tell the story from every single side. This is a particular point of view, and I should clarify that it's not necessarily my point of view or that of BFM. I conducted this interview in early July. This was just after the removal of Morsi by the military coup. I was in Norway when I met Rauf Boutros-Ghali. He is an 85-year-old businessman who's married to a Norwegian artist, and he comes from a very influential family that forms part of the Coptic Christian minority. They're about 10% of Coptic Christians in Egypt. His brother is the former UN General Secretary, and his son was the finance minister under Mubarak's regime. His grandfather was Prime Minister of Egypt from 1908 until he was assassinated in 1910. So Rove is not a politician, as he readily admits. But I think at 85 years of age, he's seen the country evolve and can offer some unique insights and perspectives into the current events and the challenges facing the country. You know, we can talk a bit about what's happening in Egypt, but I was interested also to know a bit more about, you know, your background and also how things were in Egypt when you were young and growing up, because we always hear that Cairo was a very cosmopolitan city and how it's changed, you know.
When you see Cairo, it has been a cosmopolitan city since the arrival of Muhammad Ali. So around the 1800, when Muhammad Ali came from Albania to rule and take over the governorate of Egypt. And he imported a lot of foreigners to create an administration. By this, it became a very cosmopolitan town. It is not from my time. It is even before, a long time before. And the prevalent language was, for almost the, let us say, the elite, was the French and English on top of Arabic. So when Nasser came in 1952, it changed. He took away the king, and we had a military government that lasted up till lately, 3 years ago, when there was this revolution that I would call the revolution of the computer. Because in fact, the people that went into Tahrir Square were all the young people that used the computer, that connected to each other with the computer. And that is today in Egypt, I would say a big majority, or I would say almost 80% of the young are related to the computer. And this is how I was listening the other day, today, on a comment on the last movement against Morsi, where they said 33 million Egyptian came out in the streets. And it is the first time that this happens anywhere in the world, that one-third of, or almost 40% of the population of a country as big as Egypt comes out in the street to demonstrate and say, no, it's enough.
But what are they saying no to? You say that they're a generation of the computer, but the computer is a tool. What is the message? What are the values that are driving them?
Freedom. Basically freedom and the physical and intellectual freedom that has come through the computer, that has opened horizon that they could not have had if they did not have this tool. In fact, the tool has been as if a sort of mirror that reflected what is in the world, what the world thinks now, not 50 years ago.
But do you think that under the previous regime they were oppressed, or it was an unfair system?
I wouldn't say oppressed, and I wouldn't say unfair system. It was very corrupt. But, I mean, they were putting a strong government that was, I would say, trying to prevent any movement against them, but in fact there was a certain stability, even if there was corruption.
I guess, the last time I saw you was also here in Norway about 3 years ago, and now, you know, we're back, we're both in Norway. What has the last 3 years been like in Egypt after, you know, the revolution, if you like? Because oftentimes the people who start the revolution are not the people who fill the power vacuum, right?
Yes, but you see, the last 2 years have been very difficult for me personally, in the fact that I'm at the head of a travel agency. a big travel agency in Egypt. And when the revolution came, there was not one tourist coming to Egypt. And when you have 400 employees, you don't know how to feed them or how to pay them. So it was quite, and it is up till now, quite a difficult way of surviving. Well, we hope, I mean, that this movement that happened, that shocked the world, in fact, when you see 35 million coming into the streets of a whole country, of all the towns of this country, and say, no, we don't want this anymore, it has given a current of sympathy to Egypt, and there is a movement of tourism coming back. It is a safe country, and unless the terrorist Muslim brothers start some stupid things, I don't think that they will be able to succeed in doing anything of that sort, because they don't have the approval of the majority of the population. They had, at a certain time, the sympathy, because they played on religion as a tool. And they played the fact that for 8 years they were in jail, in concentration camps. But then, when they came out, they behaved so stupidly. They used this religion, which is a very clear and easy religion, very badly. They got the worst out of any religion, but they got the worst out of the Quran and started applying it. And that made, I think, a majority of Egyptians realize that they are not made for governing. They haven't got the capacity to do this. They're so fanatic that I consider them almost as terrorists.
But do they don't have much support among the, you know, the general population in Egypt?
Well, if you have 40% of the population that comes out in one day to say no to the regime of the Muslim Brother, I think they don't have anybody that is for them, except the core of the Muslim Brothers fanatics, which is approximately, in my opinion, should represent 7 or 8% of the population. We cannot deny that. But they're brainwashed. They use the religion as a tool to transform it into something unbelievably bad.
The history of Egypt, in terms of, you know, the mix of different religions, a secular government. I mean, what are the different forces at play? Are people comfortable with the role of religion in society?
You see, the religion has always been a tool, but never used the way it was used by the Muslim Brothers. Yes, there is a difference. There is a majority of Muslims. There is 10% or 12% of Christian. They have survived since 670, when Amr with his 6,000 warriors came to Egypt and opened Egypt. Opened Egypt because the Christians of Egypt were in a fight with Constantinople, in a theological fight, and they said, oh, these are monotheistic. They will prevent. They will help us against the fanatics of Constantinople. And if there was not a way to survive, they wouldn't have survived. They would have been pressured to become Muslim, and you wouldn't have had up to now 12% of the population that is Christian. So it is an open country. And an easy country to live with, because also don't forget, you have one of those most incredible climate the whole year long. Where we're here now in the north of Norway, we're in plain summer and freezing to death. Well, in Egypt you don't have it. Summer is summer, winter is winter, and winter the maximum temperature will go down to 10 degrees by night. Much more humane. And you have sunshine. You see, I think that people that have 300 days of sunshine have a different temperament and a different way of looking at life than people that live half their life under rain, fog, darkness. No.
But I mean, one of the things that is, you know, seems to be happening in Egypt, there are a lot of different, you know, sort of global interests. You talk about the rise of Islamization, you talk about the American, you know, foreign policy interest. It seems like there's different games playing at the same time.
I was listening to the radio and wondering why did the Americans boast or promote the Muslim Brothers? The Muslim Brothers, with all due respect, are a terrorist organization. And there Mr. Obama and the American administration comes and boasts them and helps them. I don't understand. It is not clear. The proof of the fact that they are not liked is the minute they got rid, Egypt got rid of the Muslim Brothers, Saudi Arabia came and gave a loan of $4 billion. The Emirate gave $3 billion. The Kuwait gave $3 billion. I mean, that means that they are themselves are scared from the Muslim Brothers. They do not trust them. It doesn't make sense that the biggest democracy, well, with no comments on that, in the world, start promoting a terrorist organization that can put the whole Middle East in a mess. If they have been promoting them for a year and then suddenly they realize that the whole country that for whom you're promoting these terrorists do not want them. I'm not a politician. Yeah. I'm a travel agent, basically. I want peace. I want people to come and come to Egypt and to admire the pyramids, to see the monuments that are 7,000 and 8,000 years old, and see the splendor of this country.
I mean, you talked about your, you know, your business as a travel agent and the impact that this unrest has had. I mean, is it the same for most business people in Egypt? What's the situation?
Well, the situation is bad. The mismanagement that the Muslim Brother did for 1 year and 1 year and a half. I mean, I remember the other day when I came to Norway, it took me 2.5 hours to go from my house to the airport because we were on the road. There were a gas station packed with cars trying to get gasoline so that it was blocking the streets. It took me 2 hours when usually it takes me half an hour to go to the airport. I mean, that proves a mismanagement. After the Mr. Morsi was deposed, as if by magic, you had gasoline in all gas stations, didn't have any queue. But that means that there is a tremendous mismanagement. We used to have electricity cuts in the middle of the day, in the middle of the night. And, you know, when it's hot, you have your air condition on, or your fridge is on, or your, and suddenly everything stops. Then after Mr. Morsi disappeared, as by chance, electricity came continuously. Try and explain this to me. I don't know.
But now with the recent events, are people more hopeful? I mean, what are the specific desires, you think?
I left before the 30th of June. So I have the echo of what's happening. Certainly the people are much, much more optimistic. But they are scared because, as I said again, these are terrorist people. I mean, when you see what they did, for example, the foreign media did not show, that the local media showed Muslim Brothers throwing kids from the third floor of buildings to kill them. And it was on TV, Egyptian TV, but it was never on CNN or on the other TV stations. as if it was meant not to show the bad side of the Muslim Brothers.
Where does Egypt, or should Egypt, now kind of find stability and peace and you know, prosperity? What do you think, who can provide the security that's needed now?
Just fair elections.
Okay.
And you will see. I mean, people have woken up, and I guarantee you that even if Muslim Brother will present themselves for election, they will not be elected. They will have a very small minority in the parliament. But once you have unrigged elections, you have a chance to have, because it's a country that is rich, that has potential. But it has one defect, and this, I have to say it, and then I give the example of myself. When I was 18, it was a long time ago, we were 18 million inhabitants in Egypt. I am 85 today. We are 90 million inhabitants. And this is the calamity of Egypt. You have too many people on a land that is shrinking.
So what are the implications of having too many people in such a small place?
Economically, you have much more poverty. You have to beg left and right. You have to feed those people. The land has not increased. We are limited by two deserts and a quantity of water that is limited. We cannot create water. So the production of wheat, for example, we used to produce and export in the days of my father or my grandfather. They used to export wheat. We are importing 50% of our wheat from abroad. So just to give you an example, you see, it is difficult with this increase of population. You cannot really have an education that is up to the standard which you would want. And you, as long as you have not found the way to stop this increase, we will be faced with almost a calamity, not a catastrophe, but a calamity. If Nasser would have done it properly, we would have been twice as rich.
I'm speaking to Raouf Boutrousgali on the situation facing Egypt. In a moment, we're going to talk more on the future of Egypt and the kind of leadership that he believes that Egypt needs. But now, a musical interlude. So Cairo in the 1950s and 60s was, from the sounds of it, quite a happening place. So Salah Ragab and the Cairo Jazz Band was formed back in 1968. Here they are with the Egyptian Strut.
Yeah.
I'm speaking to Raouf Boutrous-Ghali on the situation facing Egypt. I mean, you mentioned when you were, you know, 18 years old, and I mean, what was life like in Egypt then?
Well, it was, let me say, it was a part of Europe, a little part of Europe. You had a very cosmopolitan, I'm talking about Cairo, a very cosmopolitan population, Cairo, Alexandria. You had foreign communities that were Greeks, Italians, whatever call them, you would find them in Egypt. It was a very agreeable and a very, very nice country.
I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, the things that are happening also in Istanbul and Turkey now seem a little bit similar to be this clash between the East and West in terms of...
I think Istanbul is, again, the waking up of the computer. It's the effect of the computer because they do not want this religious party. And Mr. Erdogan is very religious. So they don't want it. They want to be free. And they picked up on a park being transformed into a mall or something like this, this Arab Spring again. It is an awakening of young people that do not trust anymore the people that tell you a religion is first.
So it's a contest around whether or not the government should be secular. But what role should religion have in a society like in Egypt, where you have majority Muslims? Isn't it their right to have a Muslim government if they want one?
If you want a Muslim government, you're going to cut hands. You're going to put women in a hole and throw them with, kill them with stones, stoning them. If you take religion as it is all the religions, I would say, not only Islam, they have rules and regulations that do not agree anymore with our way of life, with our mentality, with our knowledge. Heaven is created of seven different levels. Where do you have it? They don't admit evolution. We were created, Adam was created by a piece of mud, there is a limit where you believe in, it's your own belief, but don't impose it on the rest.
But even in a country where the majority is Muslim?
But in the majority in Europe are Christians. Do they impose their religion? They don't. Turkey was, for example, up till the revival of this pro-Islamic party, was absolutely secular and violently secular. You had every now and then a movement of the army because they didn't want, and the army was totally secular. So you can have a secular country even if the population is totally Muslim. In Turkey, it's 99% of the population that is Muslim. In Egypt, no. In Egypt, you have 12% Christians, or we don't have any Shia, almost. Mm-hmm. We are Sunnis. And that's it.
I mean, it's interesting that we're seeing these this kind of conflict in Turkey, in Egypt, even in, you know, in America, they have a rise of sort of fundamental Christian kind of perspectives. Why do you think this is happening now? Why are people becoming more extreme now than, say, when you were younger?
I don't know. Yeah. To tell you frankly, I don't know. Why? And you see it also in Christianity, extreme Christianism. But I mean, it's total nonsense. World is changing. We'll have to see how it will end up.
So then just you know, finally, when you talk about the future of Egypt, I mean, who do you think will be, you know, you talk about free elections, but what kind of leadership do you think Egypt needs now?
You know, you have a lot of very knowledgeable people in Egypt. The standard of the intellectual level of the Egyptian society is quite high. So they have the possibility of creating, of having a very democratic and very liberal country. And this is what I wish for Egypt.
That was Rauf Boutros-Ghali, whom I interviewed in July this year. We sincerely hope that the situation in Egypt stabilizes without further loss of life, as we commemorate our own struggle for independence and self-determination. And that brings us to the end of this week's special edition of Night on Earth. I hope you've enjoyed the program, and do join me again next week for another episode of Night on Earth. I'm Shifa Situ, and you're listening to BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.